So welcome to the Fatigue Super Conference. Often the unsung heroes in healing journeys are those which are on the sideline, which, you know, on one hand, one might say they're not suffering as much because they're not going through the physical symptoms. I would argue sometimes they are suffering as much, and in some situations they're suffering more, watching their loved ones in incredibly difficult life circumstances and often feeling disempowered, clueless, kind of like a ship without a kind of rudder, of not really knowing how to help, what to do, how to be the best support. And for this series, I'm talking with Nick Cook, who is the husband of a former patient of the Optum Health Clinic, who has a kind of, I think, quite an interesting set of perspectives, in a sense, that obviously his journey as being Nyssa's husband and support through that. He's also more recently been going through our therapeutic coaching practitioner training program, which has given some additional elements perhaps to the understanding. And before we started recording this, Nick was saying that, of course, if he came through that program before, he might have had a few more strategies and tools to support. But in this session, we're going to explore Nick and Lissa's story, but primarily from Nick's perspective. And we'll kind of follow the narrative of the journey that they went on, but really some of the key lessons that Nick learned along the way. And I think it'll be a combination of lessons learned at the time and lessons discovered in hindsight that he wishes he'd learned at the time. But Nick, welcome back, and thanks for joining me again on this session. No
problem. Glad to be here.
So this time I get to ask the questions, which...
Yes. I'm feeling a bit more nervous about this.
So, well, let's start from the beginning. So, as we touched on a bit in the last session when you were asking me about it, the process of getting a diagnosis of fatigue, and obviously we're talking to a broad range of fatigue in this conference, and for some people this might just be a relatively mild fatigue that just impacts the quality of their life. For others it could be a very severe kind of chronic fatigue or fibromyalgia or ME sort of situation. But for you guys, when Lissa got her diagnosis, that can be a bit of a double-edged sword. It can be quite an emotional roller coaster. So maybe talk a bit about what perhaps the kind of the circumstance, but also how that was particularly for you at that time.
Well, I mean, it was a fairly drawn-out process in that Lissa had not been right for a long, long time. Sort of periods of being able to manage everything and then just periods of crashing. And we went through a load of sort of traditional medical pathways. An endocrinologist found that she did have this pituitary tumor, which involved, you know, made her secrete a lot of prolactin hormone, which had a big impact on her, and then the medication she had to take for that. And there was a lot of instances like that where somebody would say, "Oh, it's this," and we'd say, "Oh, that's going to sort it." I remember going to see the endocrinologist and feeling absolutely elated afterwards that we'd got to the bottom of why she had all of these issues and that she was going to take this medication and it was all going to be fine. And then it wasn't, because then the medication hit her and she still wasn't fine. So then she took a month off work and she got better in that month, but then this moment she went back again, it all kicked in again. So eventually it was a doctor that I knew from a sports background. He worked with a lot of pro cycling teams, said, you know, did some blood work with her and said, "Look, there's nothing on the blood work, but based on everything you told me, this looks like the burnout fatigue that I see a lot of time with elite athletes. And it's a very similar condition. I think you have some form of chronic fatigue." And I think both our reaction was quite similar to that, in that Lissa was very much, "No, I haven't got that. I'm not having that. That's not happening." And I think I was a bit like that, thinking, oh, you know, everything I've read about this, everything I've known about this, you know, sort of, you don't get better from it. It's a life sentence. You know, so you'll have people who won't believe you've actually got anything wrong with you. And I just went to this sort of spiral of sort of, catastrophe, how this was just going to unravel our life and that there was no way out of it. And then I think we both sort of stuck our heads in the sand for a bit about it. And it all really came to a head. We were actually on holiday in Holland. And, you know, this was actually having a bit of an up. We're showing this to happen, so we should have these ups and we'd think, oh, she's fine. There's actually nothing wrong with her. And yeah, we went on holiday in Holland with her mum. And we went out, I think, for a sort of half hour bike ride, flat bike ride to Holland.
Right.
And she was laid out for 3 days after that. And the year previously, we'd been on holiday in the Vosges in France, and she'd been riding Tour de France climbs. And she was just absolutely laid out flat by this one bike ride. And, you know, we were walking to the sort of the pancake house down the coast, and there was a slight incline, and her 77-year-old mother was going up this incline faster than she was.
Wow.
Both her mum and I said, there's something really wrong here. We need to sort this. And I think that's when she also realised that there was something properly wrong.
I mean, I think part of what can be so difficult in that situation is that we're so used to going to medical professionals, getting a clear diagnosis, getting a clear treatment path, even if that treatment path is one that's not to full recovery, but a sense of these are the parameters of what you can expect, and these are the things that we're going to do, and these are the likely outcomes that will come from doing that. And I think often that uncertainty and that kind of just kind of being left in the dark really can be almost quite traumatizing for both parties going through that experience.
Oh, definitely. It's that not knowing. And I think the default reaction to not knowing is to think that the worst is going to happen. So if you're faced with this, this black hole, and you think, well, it's not going to be good what's in that black hole.
Yeah. And so how did things unfold from that point? So you in time you got this diagnosis that Lisa didn't like, so it didn't count. I guess that there was a realization in time that actually really this is what's going on.
I have some real clear memories of the whole process, and one of them is that conversation with her mum sat in Holland, and the next one is actually on the way journey back from Holland, just Lisa on her phone researching everything there was to research about chronic fatigue, ordering books left, right, and centre, buying up Holland and Barrett online. I think she read, I've forgotten which of the nutritional books it was, but she read one of the nutritional books literally on the journey home and just ordered everything on that list. And she just, you could see it was almost like this mania.
For those outside the UK, Holland and Barrett is the kind of one of the high street health food stores. It's a kind of Planet Organic sort of equivalent or Whole Food sort of equivalent in the US.
And I just got this feeling that I had to at that point take a little bit of a stand back and just it was obvious she needed to go through this. I think, you know, even if she didn't get to the bottom of it herself, there was part of me that felt good that she was actually engaging with what Dr. Will had said. It was this chronic fatigue. But then there was another part of me that was thinking, you're just scattergunning at this. We need to sort of take a more sort of measured approach and a more sort of logical approach.
Well, I think that's one of the challenges as well, isn't it? That you kind of... You, the person that's going through being ill has this sense of being completely out of control and kind of powerless in terms of what's happening. So what you don't want to do is kind of try and force them too much down certain paths, but also you are going through it together. And I kind of wonder how you guys navigated that, wanting to give her the freedom to make her own choices whilst also perhaps having some difference of opinions sometimes.
I found that quite hard. Lisa is quite a force of nature. and I think, I think that has been and was a contributing factor to her illness, was her very sort of high achiever type personality. She's always worked on that sort of mental. The more you put effort into things, the better the results are going to be. So And I could just see that she was just expending so much energy into trying to find her cure for this. And I had this feeling in the back of my mind that I knew that it wasn't going to be a simple fix. But whenever I would try and say, are you sure you need to be taking all of these things? Are you sure you need to be doing this? Are you sure that's going to work for you? The reaction wouldn't necessarily be hostile, but it was quite a difficult phase. Mm. And it felt very much, the onus was all on us, because at that point we weren't seeking any outside expert advice or talking to anyone or whatever. And so for that reason, one of the biggest weights off my mind was when Lissa did sign up for the OHC. Then suddenly there was somebody else involved.
Yeah. And before we come to that, I'm also curious as to how it was. You mentioned Lissa's mum.
Yeah.
How was, because when we talk about carers, it's not just kind of intimate partner. There's lots of different constellations of this. It can be parents that are caring for it. It can be children. It can be siblings. It can be close friends. It can be romantic partners. But how was it for Lissa and her mum, and how was it for you and Lissa's mum? Like, how did that dynamic work?
Lissa's mum was absolutely invaluable. If it hadn't been for her, I don't know if we would have got through it, to be honest. And as much for the support she gave me as for the support she gave Lissa, during that first diagnosis period, but also then when Lissa was actually probably at her most ill, Lissa's mum effectively came up and lived with us for quite a long period of time. And she would happily take a lot of the flack that Lissa would be giving out. She would take that time, to sit with Lissa. She would take the being shouted at. But she would also, she gave me that space, but then she was also this objective sounding board that I had as well for all the feelings that I was going through. And she was just an absolute rock. And I think, one of the main things I'd say to anyone who's caring for somebody with fatigue is that you need somebody else.
Yeah.
Not necessarily in situ like I was so fortunate to have, but somebody who you can talk to, you can offload to, you can bounce things off. Because that was just absolutely, that was a lifesaver. It really was.
Yes. I mean, it sounds like it was an enormously important role. And I can imagine also at times, quite frustrating. I mean, I have a very good relationship with my mother-in-law, but I do find that after a certain amount of time, I want my own space. So I wonder how that was for you, in a sense, that knowing that your mother-in-law was a really important part of the picture in terms of the support network. But I would assume that also at times probably quite frustrating, that wanting Lissa to be well, wanting to be able to do things together, and wanting to have your own kind of space. I mean, how did you navigate that?
I mean, it's not necessarily a normal situation to have your mother-in-law living with you effectively. But again, I'm really lucky that she's actually very low maintenance, very independent. She gets on with her own thing. So that wasn't so much of an issue. And to be honest, I can only really sense, I only really had positives from it. And it's quite interesting now that when we do spend time, we're going to be staying down there this weekend, for example, in her flat. And undoubtedly she will wind me up. And I think that's actually, a really strong indicator of where Lissa is in her recovery and where we are as a couple in her recovery, in that we now have a lot of much more normalized relationship.
Sign of progress.
Yeah, exactly. I remember this huge sense of relief when she would come to stay, and this almost dread when she would go and I'd be then on my own with Lissa, particularly when Lissa was at her most ill.
And And I know that you've mentioned to me before that there were, of course, there were times when Lissa would have got frustrated, she would have got pissed off. I mean, anyone going through a situation like severe fatigue that doesn't is probably not owning their anger. Like in a sense, the healthy way through it is sometimes there's going to be some blow-ups. But how was that for, you mentioned that Lissa's mum was getting some of that, but I'm sure you were getting some of that as well. How was that kind of just, you know, seeing someone in so much frustration and having to kind of also be intimate and close with that?
That was really hard. You know, there were days when, you know, there were weeks when, you know, Lissa would be effectively bedbound. And this wasn't the girl I fell in love with. This wasn't the woman that I married. You know, and she was so angry and frustrated, but in such a strange, resigned way. You know, it's almost as if she didn't have the energy to be angry. And I remember her saying one day, "Oh, I wish I was dead, but I can't be bothered to do anything about it."
Wow.
And, you know, sorry. and that hurt so much. And, you know, when she would get frustrated, and when, you know, inevitably I would say the wrong things, you know, sort of, you know, I'd try and be positive when she was in no frame of mind for me to be positive, or I'd be negative or realistic when she wanted me to be positive. And, you know, I'd get a sort of reaction, and it was incredibly hurtful. And that's where having that objective sounding board and her mother really helped. In that I could say, "Oh, Lissa, you know, Lissa said this today," and her mum would, you know, say, "You know, that's not really her talking, that's the illness talking. She knows she can say these things to us, you know, because she loves us, and she feels comfortable saying these things to us." And to an extent, I almost then sort of in another mechanism to protect myself, I almost separated off ill Lissa from Lissa.
The analogy
that I almost used, I don't know if you're sort of almost familiar with the film like The Exorcist. So
only very vaguely, so you're going to need more than that.
So it was almost like this demonic possession, in that there was this part of her that was this incredibly angry, lashing out, but it wasn't really her.
Yes.
And, you know, I had to take those things at this demon, for want of a better word, was throwing out. But I also had to not take them to heart as much as possible.
I think that's a very helpful way of separating it, right? Because in a sense, if it's your lover, your wife, your intimate partner, the person that you've kind of committed your kind of life to, which is angry, frustrated, taken out to you, that's very painful. And if you can separate that, I think it's the first time I've heard it described in that way, but I think it's actually very good. I think if you can separate it in that way, you can still love her. Just, it's a little bit like with parenting, right? It's that you can love the child but dislike the behavior. And if you can separate those two pieces, you can respond with love whilst also have certain levels of boundary of kind of how you kind of limit the kind of impact of the behavior. And so that sounds like a really good strategy. And I suppose what I also wonder is, at that time, and I know that perhaps with some of the deeper insight that you've gathered over the kind of years and through doing the kind of course since, I'm sure that there's some other pieces that you might want to add as well. But I guess at the time, what else were you doing to take care of yourself? Like, obviously having Lissa's mum there was a support. Were you making time? I know cycling is a great love of yours. Were you making time to go and do that, to spend time with friends? Like, how was the kind of your life outside of being carer sort of thing?
I mean, that's a game where Lissa's mum was invaluable, in that you know, for me, getting out for sort of, you know, 4 or 5 hours on the bike is my release. And having her there, it allowed me to do that guilt-free.
Right.
Whereas there was, you know, Lissa wasn't, you know, sort of, she didn't need, you know, 24-hour surveillance or 24-hour care as such. You know, most of the time she was, you know, in bed either asleep or trying to read, or, you know, when the brain fog wasn't too bad, or watching, you know, sort of box sets or whatever. So I could have gone out when Lissa's mum wasn't there, but I didn't want to, almost, because the guilt that I'd feel about doing that would be too great. And it was similar with going out and seeing friends as well, in that, you know, I would feel bad and I'd want to be out with Lissa.
Yes. And it's tricky if you're used to going out as a couple, right?
And so, you know, that would be really, so I think we both became a lot more isolated as a couple during that period. And it was hard to manage that. And I think one of the things that you do really notice with fatigue is that it's really hard from a social perspective. And undoubtedly we did lose friends.
Yes.
Because of it, you know, sort of, you know, at the beginning when Lissa was first ill, you know, sort of you'd have friends who would be sort of, you know, ask, you know, you'd be asked out to things as normal, but you keep on having to say, no, we can't. And eventually people stop asking.
Yes.
And you know, and the other difficulty is it's such a subtle and insidious illness, in that, you know, if she had a good, you know, if she was feeling good on a Friday afternoon, you know, we might try and sort of, you know, walk down to the pub, you know, just, and people would see her out and about and they'd see her, but they'd only see her because she was having a good 5-6 hours. You know, they wouldn't see her the rest of the week. So and because it's not a tangible illness, there's nothing that people can see. And you do have these little ups where you are okay and you are able to do something. Yeah, we did. And our friend circle was very much based around cycling, running and things like that. And so that made it difficult as well. So we did lose friends.
And I think it's an important point that you raise as well, that the kind of fluctuating nature of fatigue is such that it's quite difficult for people to understand, because normally people assume, like, you know, you break your leg and you are at a certain stage of that recovery process, which is fairly consistent, and most conditions are like that. Yeah. Whereas with fatigue, because it can be so fluctuating and up and down, and there can be so much cultural misunderstanding in a sense to what's happening, that ultimately the people that we most need support from are kind of close friends and kind of family. Often they can be the people that are the least helpful, because they don't really understand what's happening.
And ironically, when Lissa was actually at her illest, I did break my leg.
Did you? That must have been a
good one. Oh yeah, yes. And I think Lissa actually found it really frustrating that I suddenly got this support from people.
Yeah.
You know, when I had this broken leg. And she vocalized that. She was saying, all these people are coming round and doing this and this and this, and that didn't happen for me. And yeah, so that was quite interesting.
Yes.
And quite difficult to handled. I mean, the upside of me breaking my leg was that we actually had a really nice period of time when we were both effectively housebound. It's sort of, I think it gave me a lot of, you know, sort of empathy at that time. And we could do things together because we were both incapacitated.
There is something that is it's interesting, actually. I've had a number of patients say over the years that they're one of their loved ones has suddenly become much more empathic and understanding because they've had terrible flu for 5 days or a week or something. And they've suddenly realized how awful it is possible to feel. And they've kind of gone, oh my God, is that how you feel the whole time? Like, yeah. Oh my God, like how have you done that for the last year or 5 years or, you know, whatever it is. So there is something about that kind of empathy that comes from having had one's own experience.
Yeah, definitely. And during that time, you know, I had the thing I loved doing most, going out on the bike. I had that taken away from me.
Right.
For 5 months, I think it was. And I suddenly realized, wow, this is what happened to Lissa. You know, she used to love riding a bike. She used to love running. And I suddenly had an idea of what it was like. But the difference was I had, you know, this incredibly structured rehabilitation process in place. You know, I had a physio who was telling me, right, in 12 weeks, we're going to be taking that cast off. In 16 weeks, we're going to have you on an exercise bike and we're going to have you pedaling through a full range of motion, you know. And I knew exactly, and I had, you know, these targets. Whereas, as I said, for Lissa, it was this black hole of unknowing about, well, was she ever going to get better? Was she ever going to get back to normal life?
Yeah, which is obviously incredibly, incredibly unsettling. And I know that you make, just back up, but you mentioned then there was a point where you found OHC or the Optimum Health Clinic. What was, and you please don't be polite, just tell me how it is. But how, what was that like for both of you? Often I think what can happen is that the one that's suffering can be the one that does the research and kind of understands it. Sometimes those around them can be quite skeptical and cynical. Was that your experience? Might not have been your experience.
Yeah, no, I think definitely to start with, I probably did bury my head in the sand quite a lot. And, you know, I didn't want to sort of read, particularly when Liz was going through her sort of manic self-diagnosis and self-treatment space, I didn't want to read all the books that she was telling me I should be reading, because I just didn't feel it was sort of, you know, honing in on what the problem was. And to start with the OHC, I was probably similar as well. I mean, there was, as I said, there was this big sense of relief that somebody else was dealing with her. But I was still thinking, you know, sort of, I remember being, when I was a student, I lived with medical students. And I remember one of them coming home saying, "Oh, we did about ME today. Might exist."
That's about the size of that, I think, in medical school, eventually. Yeah.
And, you know, sort of, and there was, you know, and I come from a very sort of rigorous scientific background, you know, sort of my own sort of, you know, degree, etc. And so I was sort of, you know, sort of quite skeptical. And I remember sort of she went down for the first. I don't know, is it the first
90-day program for the three?
Yeah, 90-day. Yeah. And I remember getting a phone call from her saying, "Oh, I don't know why I'm here. There's a load of people sat in the room doing nutty tapping stuff." And I was thinking, "Oh no, this isn't going to happen either." But then I think as I think Lissa embraced it and found the bits that worked for her and found the things that worked for her and started, particularly when she started working with her therapist, I started sort of looking and reading through the material she was getting. And I think that was a real turning point in that once we were both sort of singing from the same sort of hymn sheet, it made a massive difference. And we had that sort of, not that we were attacking this from the same place, but we were sort of at least coming from vaguely the same direction on it.
Yes. Although I think one of the things that can be quite interesting at that stage is that the one that's going through the program starting to develop a new vocabulary, in a sense, a new kind of mindset, a new way of doing things, a new way of not doing things. And I sometimes hear that the experience of those around them is that suddenly everything they do and say is wrong because they're not kind of, they haven't had that same training, and also it's so nuanced of what's appropriate at each point. Did you find that challenging, being someone that was trying to support someone on a program that you weren't indoctrinated into the kind of world, in a sense?
Oh, definitely. I mean, and you know, I remember lying in bed one morning and I could hear this humming and could feel the bed by sort of slightly vibrating, and she was humming "Happy Birthday" to herself. I was thinking, what that? And I just remember just laying there thinking, what is going on? And, you know, it's only when I sort of said to her, "Were you humming?" Then she explained what she was doing. And yeah, so, and yeah, she did have this totally new sort of mindset. And she was trying to sort of, and I remember her saying, right, I can't overly stimulate my parasympathetic nervous system. So we're not watching television after X clock at night, and we're not watching anything that's horror or sort of overly sort of violent drama. I think we're basically only watching rubbish comedies.
So basically nothing that you as a guy wanted to watch.
No, exactly. And I sort of think, well, I've got to go with this. But there were definitely times when I was thinking, I really don't know what's going on here.
Yeah. And just for the uninitiated, I think I'll just explain the happy birthday piece. Otherwise, yes, they might genuinely think it's a kind of crackpot. So as part of emotional freedom technique, which is the, and in fact, we have one of the interviews in this online conference, which is Dr. Craig Wiener talking about EFT, that one of the parts of that sequence is that we do a set of strange things with kind of eye movements and kind of counting and that sort of thing. We also get people to hum something, and often it's happy birthday because everyone knows happy birthday. And there's a logic around the kind of switching between different kind of sides of the brain and different kind of focuses. So there's a reason why we do that, but I think it looks genuinely crazy to people on the outside that don't necessarily aren't initiating what's going on.
Yeah, definitely, particularly when you're lying in bed in the morning. Yeah.
Noted. As things started to change and improve, Alyssa, it's rarely is it a straight line of recovery. Normally, it's a few steps forward, it's a step back, it's five steps forward, it's three steps back, a step to the left, a step to the right. You know, it's a process of evolution, and there's lots of kind of nuance to what's most helpful at different stages. How was that for you guys in terms of almost like, you suddenly get a sense of, oh my God, we're on the right track. And then it can be a sense of, oh, kind of deflating, oh, we're not. How did you guys navigate that? And how was that for you?
I think I sort of saw that better than Lissa saw it.
Interesting.
I think she actually, whether it was a protective mechanism or she just genuinely didn't remember, I don't think, even now, I don't think she remembers quite how ill she was. And I also don't think she remembers that whenever during her recovery, she introduced something new, you know, whether it was going to do half a day's work at the local radio station or whether it was starting to lecture at the university again, there would be a bounce back. And so she would automatically go into, I'm getting ill again, I'm never going to get better, I can't cope with this. Whereas I would remember how this pattern had been. And I'd be able to say, actually, no, you know, when you did this last time, this happened. And the most recent example of that was when she started doing her student teaching. The first week of being a student teacher, she came home every afternoon and probably slept for 4 or 5 hours before, you know, once she got home. So she'd get home at say 3, 4 o'clock and she'd sleep until 8 that evening, get up, have something to eat and then go back to bed again. And for the first week, she did that every evening and the weekend, she just crashed completely. The next week, probably 3 out of 4 weekdays, one day at the weekend, she slept. Next week, it was probably 1 or 2. And it's been a case of reminding her that has been the cycle throughout. And it's just the way her body needs to adapt to it. And I think sort of having that and maintaining that objectivity, but making sure that it's realistic objectivity, is a really, really important role that you can do.
Well, I think that's one of the, as you say, one of the really helpful roles that you can play as a carer, that you can, in a sense, because you're not quite so physically and emotionally kind of impacted by the ups and downs. One of the things that people often forget is that when someone crashes physically, they also crash emotionally, because the whole a capacity to produce hormones is often kind of diminished in that period. So one is producing less cortisol, one less adrenaline, less dopamine or whatever else. So it isn't just physically one's exhausted, their mind, their emotions will tend to go down with it. So it becomes quite hard to be objective when one is in a crash. And also memory is state dependent. So the state we're in will help us access the memories that link to that. So that's why when we're in love, we remember all the things in our life that we love. And when we're in a kind of state of anxiety, we remember all the things that we're kind of worried about. So when you get someone goes into a crash, it's often quite hard to actually see it from an objective point of view. And that's one of the real values of someone on the outside, such as yourself, who's able to kind of go, well, actually, I can see more of a clear trend here. So it sounds like that doing that and helping Lisa to see that was something that you were able to do that was really supportive.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a sort of flawless process. you have to time it. You know, so there are definitely times when, you know, Lisa might be, you know, having a crash, and if you suddenly sort of say to her, "Well, actually, this time, last time," then you're going to get a bad reaction to that. Yeah. So you know, you've got to judge it. There have been times when, you know, I go into that sort of cycle of, "Oh God, you are getting ill again. You're not going to get well again," and I think that's where, having done sort of, well, working on the practitioner course, I've learned some strategies for myself that have allowed me better to cope when I'm sort of getting into that sort of mindset.
Yeah.
And also, it was, ironically, it was during the recovery phase, really, that I actually sought therapeutic help myself. You know, I think in hindsight, it probably would have been a very good idea for me to have done that much earlier. But from my own point of view, the issues that I really had were during recovery rather than during illness.
So say a bit more about that. But sometimes I think what can happen is, as someone starts to improve, it's almost like the people around are able to, it's almost like when someone's in a kind of crisis, everyone around's kind of in a state of kind of, my God, it's kind of like a stress response. We have to deal with the crisis. And it's almost that as we start to see that the crisis is, although they might still be ill, we're coming out of this, there's progress, we're moving forwards, that somehow everyone calms down a bit and relaxes a bit. And there's actually more contact with one's emotions. And it's almost like, so it's like kind of in someone is in a war zone and handles it completely, seemingly okay, comes back from the war zone and then has PTSD. They weren't the signs and they were there, but it's when they're safe enough to feel it, suddenly that stuff starts to get felt. Was that kind of some of your experience, or was it something different?
I think that there are a few areas and a few issues. There was an issue like that you sort of come out of firefighting mode and you have more time to engage with your sort of your own feelings and emotions. You know, sort of you're not giving so much of your emotional energy to this other person. So you have got a bit of time thinking, oh, how am I feeling now about this? You know, I think there was also quite a sense of doubt and worry about, is she really getting better? Can I back down? Can I stand down? So there was that. There was also, I'd probably developed a real identity as a carer, as a caregiver, you know, and had a role doing that, you know, and it was a big role in my life doing that, and a big identity with that. And there was probably this sort of slightly perverse part of me that didn't want to, you know, was scared of giving that up. You know, would I still have a part in Lisa's life when she was better? You know, she had, you know, sort of, without being cliche, genuinely transformed as a person through a lot of the stuff she had done. Would I still have this part to play in her life?
It's like, who are we as a couple on the other side of this as well, right? That there's a kind of, it's almost like you had to adapt to her being ill, and that was a hard transition. But then you almost got a comfort zone that, okay, now I know where I stand with this. Yeah. Then you have to readapt in terms to her getting well, which I think in some ways is almost a more threatening adaptation in a sense, because when someone gets ill, at least it's like, well, they're dependent upon me, so I've got some kind of power in this dynamic, you know, for better or for worse. Yeah. And then as she starts to kind of get well, it's like, well, who is she on the other side? And do I have a place in this relationship? And, you know, what is she? She's a different person, but she's still Lisa. But yeah, like trying to, I often think that there's a, a rediscovering of each other in a relationship on the other side of something like this?
Oh no, definitely. And you know, I think we're still to a point going through that stage, and still, yeah, sort of working through that stage, and yeah, and still sort of, you know, sort of, we're still coming out of the tunnel, I'd say. You know, so, you know, we're definitely heading towards the light, but so, although, you know, sort of ostensibly, physically, this is there, I still think as a couple, we're still sort of having to work at it. And I think, you know, we're both aware that we're sort of having to work at it. And I think, yeah, as I say, for me, seeking that help. So whether it's Lissa's mom, and then there's the therapist as well, you know, asking for that help and actually getting it, you know, sort of was really, really important for me.
I'm sure. And I think one of the things that's also, just to kind of make it even more explicit, one of the things I think is also quite challenging is that often on the recovery path, the one who is on that path is having to evolve and change as a person. You know, they're kind of becoming more aware of their unhelpful patterns. They're perhaps cultivating more of their positive patterns. They're reassessing their life, what's important. And for the one that's caring for them, most of their focus tends to be going into being caring, being supportive, being impacted by, I'm sure, but one's own self-development isn't necessarily happening. And normally you do get, challenges in relationships when, if you've got two people that come in and they're kind of connected because they're the same, and then we talk about a kind of dance of change, that one of them suddenly kind of moving off in a whether it's up or down, left or right, it's not really my point, but one's evolving and changing, and the other one is kind of left with, you know, one of three choices. Do you join that person in the new dance? Do you try and pull them back to the old dance? But that's not a good idea if the new dance is what's facilitating recovery, or there's the risk of dancing different dances. So I'm wondering how that process was for you, in a sense of recognizing that, hang on, Lissa's changing. Did you feel that you wanted her to pull her back, or was it just a recognition, actually, I need to go on my own journey here?
I think it was more the latter. But I'm trying to get my head around time scale. So yeah, so it came to a head, maybe 2019 now, so it would have been sort of Christmas 2017 or so. I just wasn't in a good place at all. I was, you know, feeling, you know, that was when Lissa was really starting to sort of get well again then. But mentally, I was just, you know, I felt I wasn't happy with the work I was doing. I wasn't feeling challenged. I was just feeling directionless, really. Mm. And it was, you know, it was actually Lissa who said to me, look, what do you want to do? What can we do to sort of give you that sort of interest? And that's when we started looking into sort of a change in career, a change in, or sort of an augmentation of career rather than a change in career. Maybe doing, you know, that's when we started looking at maybe doing a sort of master's in sports psychology. But then that's eventually where we came around to doing the practitioner's course. Mm. To give me, yeah, something to sort of, you know, to work towards, and to allow me to develop, and sort of, and it was almost having that permission from Lissa in a way to say, I'm okay, you go and do this now.
Yes. Yeah, well, in some ways also, yeah. I suppose your life was somewhat on hold whilst you were supporting her, right? So there's kind of almost like a double whammy. On one hand, she's evolving and changing and you're not, but also you've almost actively paused your life because you're prioritizing being available for her recovery. And I think that's also very common, that certainly that the times that, for whatever reason, I have contact with those that are caring for people, that is part of the frustration that can also build up, that it's kind of, that one's life, one is not able to self-actualize their own life because through the love and care of this other person, that's having to take priority. And that does have its own impacts over time.
Yeah. We often talk about, and I often talk to Lissa about, you know, juggling balls, in that there's a number of balls that she's potentially got in her life. She's got work, she's got social, she's got exercise. And it tends to be that at the moment, where she is, she can probably do 2 out of 3 balls at a time, and one has to be potentially put aside, or she has to bring in a sleep ball to help.
Focus ball, yeah.
Yeah. And I saw, I'd say that to her, but then taking a step back, I didn't really apply it to myself as well. And for an awful long time, I had my work as one ball, my cycling and racing as another ball, and I had Lissa, looking after Lissa as a ball. And that was my 3 balls, and there wasn't any scope for anything else. Although, you know, my work had to remain as one size of ball.
Yeah.
It couldn't grow, it couldn't change, or I couldn't add something else in. And it was only when I got that nod to say, actually, you can put me to one side now for a bit as a carer, that I could sort of consider bringing something else in. So I think it was always going to be staggered. I think she was always going to have to develop herself and change and evolve herself first. And then I was always going to have a little period of catch up.
Yeah. But I think the fact you were able to navigate that together, I think was really important, which also kind of brings me to a question around what helped you guys, what supported the communication between the two of you? Because there must have been quite a bit of moments of self-awareness and insight, but also quite a bit of dialogue, I would imagine, to discover those things. What's helped that?
Well, I think Lissa, as part of her change and evolution, I think she engaged much more with her own sort of emotions, and was a lot more mindful. I mean, she did a lot of mindfulness work and meditation and stuff like that. And I think that generally makes her a lot more aware of what's going on around her. So I think she was much more aware of that something wasn't right with me. And I think, and reciprocally, I think she encouraged me to sort of talk more and become more sort of involved. So I think we benefited each other during that time. But it was also that sort of me going and seeing a therapist. I think also me doing the practitioner's course. You know, I've got in touch with a lot of issues and things.
It's good for that.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's really helped. And I think having, and also going back to Lissa's mum, you know, she is this, for both of us, a real sort of conduit of our feelings, in that, you know, she thinks the world of both of us. And she will. So she's just somebody who can both of us can talk to, and I think it's as a couple we've come out of, or we're coming out of Lissa's illness much stronger, and we communicate so much better.
Well, that was one of my kind of closing questions to you is, we've obviously talked about the immense challenges that you guys have been on, that people, well, anyone goes on through this kind of journey, and yet. I often think about depth of friendship, let alone relationship, is created by shared experiences. And that's why, we can have friends from 20 years ago that we haven't seen in 20 years, but because we went on some crazy backpack adventure through wherever together, where we ended up sleeping rough for 3 days, that we've still got like this kind of bond and connection that's being kind of created through that. But I think the same is true when you go through as a couple, that if you're able to navigate it together, there's also a real kind of gratitude and depth of bond. I'd love to hear a bit about what the gifts have been for your relationship through this.
For her, she says getting chronic fatigue or whatever was one of the best things that ever happened to her. You know, it was a real wake-up call, a real, sort of, it made her stop. It made her stop, assess, and gave her a reason and a need to change and evolve positively, to look at what she was doing career-wise, etc. And I think it did the very much similar thing, slightly time-lagged, with me. And as you say, that shared experience You know, nobody's ever going to be able to take that away from us. You know, and the fact that we sort of got through that together, you know, and it creates a lot of other positives. I mean, going back to sort of one of the really important things that did work when Lissa was ill was environmental change for her. You know, I really, you know, and this was also when I had my broken leg as well. The number of times we'd sort of jump when I was actually able to drive again, because we had an automatic, get in a car and drive up a hill and sort of maybe toddle 20 yards to the top of the hill. But then also from the environmental point of view, Lissa very much started to associate the house that we were living in with being ill.
Yes.
And that was a catalyst for us moving house. And although we didn't move far, you know, sort of, you know, it was a really positive thing for us to do together. And so I think there were, and there have been, so many plus sides of Lissa being ill and getting through Lissa being ill. And we're definitely stronger, happier, and I think not necessarily physically healthier, but definitely mentally healthier couple because of it.
Yes. And I think you make a really good point there about, and I noticed I missed it off our plan before, but the value of changing. We talk about different types of tiredness at Optimum Health Clinic, and one of the forms of tiredness is environmental tiredness, where one gets drained by simply just being in the same space, and sometimes changing environment can give its own kind of freshness in terms of energy. That's one of the ways that, of course, a carer can help, is if someone has the energy to do it, there's never something to be imposed, but someone has the energy to do it, to go for a drive or to go and be somewhere different, with knowing that that different environment is still going to meet the various needs in terms of rest and quiet and food, whatever they may be. But that can be another way of just very practically being able to help. Nick, a question that I know is going to be on a lot of people's minds. Is your mother-in-law available for hire?
There are downsides to her as well. But yes, she's London-based, so she's very... But yes, definitely.
Is there anything else you wanted to put in here before we just wrap up and kind of set up for the next one?
I think the biggest lesson I think I've learned is to ask for help and not to take it all on your own shoulders.
Yeah.
And, you know, sort of whether that's friends, family, or, you know, a paid professional, you know, you need somebody who you can talk to and lean on. And I think I was lucky in that, as I said, I had Lissa's mum, and then I had some professional help as well. And I think I could have, in hindsight, actually benefited from more help, particularly professional help, even earlier during the recovery. Just to give coping mechanisms and to sort of help with what you're going through. And although it can probably seem slightly selfish in that you're not the one who's going through the illness, yeah, the onus that is put on you and the drain that is put on you and the feelings that you have to deal with, those feelings of guilt and all those sort of negative feelings, you know, so if you've got some way and somebody to help you deal with those, you're just going to be a better carer and be able to give better care because of that.
It is one of the things that we have such a strong emphasis on with the practitioners at the Optimum Health Clinic, is their own self-care. And it's something that I find that most practitioners that join us don't really get it until about 4 to 6 months into the job, where they have a personal crisis, a mini personal crisis, and they go, oh yeah, all that stuff that they talk about, maybe I should start following the advice. But there is something that is, if we don't take care of ourselves, we are simply, you know, this is not a sprint. This is multiple marathons that you have to do as a carer, that if you don't take care of yourself, you end up being less support and in danger of being a drain on that person. Okay. And so I think you're right. And it does take a certain amount of kind of courage and vulnerability sometimes to go, do you know what? I'm human and I need some help. And hopefully it's all three. Hopefully it's friends, it's family, and it's a professional. But even if it's one or two out of those three, that's at least a great starting point.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, 100%.
Great. Nick, thank you so much for being so willing to be so open and kind of vulnerable in terms of this. I think it would have been really helpful for people. And I'm looking forward to in our third session together, we're going to take some of the key themes from this and perhaps a few other pieces and be a bit more prescriptive in terms of some of the key principles and some of the key ways that carers can take care of themselves, be the best support they can for the person they're supporting, and some of the kind of tips and lessons. For now, thank you so much for your time and your willingness. I really appreciate it.
No problem at all.